A little like that parking lot in high school where all the kids would go and smoke pot, so we can have some fun. I am Ben Berkowitz, and you guys are attending What Civil Society Can Learn from the Social Web. My co-panelists are Lenny Retschitzky and Catherine Fink from Meetup. Lenny's from Local Mind. Daniel, been having trouble with Daniel's last name.
Daniel.
There's a reason he doesn't have his last name in his Twitter handle, because nobody would ever tweet it.
Hengfeld, sorry. from Neighbor Goods, and Doug Matthews from the City of Austin. So the format for the panel is each of us are going to introduce ourselves, where we're from, a little about the companies or the organizations that we work with. I'm going to ask a few questions and to each panelist, and then to the group. And towards the end, we'll leave 15 minutes to do questions. If you guys want to line up, start lining up towards the end, that would be excellent. So a little context. I had to do a Google search, a Wikipedia search on civil society, because I was a little unclear on the definition, and it turns out a lot of other people have been for quite some time. Civil society as a term came about hundreds of years ago as a debate between Locke and Hobbes. Essentially, the conversation was around this organization outside of family, outside of the market, and there was a question about whether government was part of civil society. It's commonly understood today that government is not considered a part of civil society. It's typically represented by volunteerism, by community groups. And in the late 1990s, this kind of changed again or evolved. Robert Putnam wrote the book, which many of you may be familiar with, called Bowling Alone. And in Bowling Alone, he talked about the decline of civil society and participation in the United States. And he used this measurement based on bowling groups and other civil groups as a way to say that people aren't participating as much. That book, actually, I believe, is given out to Meetup employees.
Yeah, every new staffer gets a copy of Bowling Alone.
And Meetup is very much a reaction to that problem. It turns out, I think most people on this panel would agree that we very much do not have a problem. We were just measuring it incorrectly. And civil society is being redefined through the empowerment of individuals in communities through the social web. And most of the people on this panel have built or are involved in platforms which actually try to solve one or two specific problems that will make neighborhoods better, will make communities better at a local place, and are really working to connect people. So anything from, in our case, getting a pothole fixed to getting an answer to something in real time, to meeting up and connecting to people in real life, to sharing something that you have, and not just sharing a photo, but sharing maybe a screwdriver. And then, of course, most importantly, governments that are really coming out of City Hall and working with citizens on a real level. So I'll kick it off. I live in New Haven, Connecticut. There are some people in the audience from New Haven, Connecticut. I was born there. I love it there. I made a T-shirt a few years ago that says New Haven. It's better than your town. You're free to disagree. And I for the last couple of years, have been involved in a number of projects. One, starting a farmer's market in my neighborhood, starting a neighborhood association. Most recently, we have created a makerspace, and also working on a local version of an international project called the Inside Out Project, which is if you saw the TED Prize winner last year, it's a huge wheat paste mural intended to really connect people in real life by putting their faces on a public wall. 4 years ago, I felt pretty disconnected from my neighbors. I was living on Upper State Street in New Haven. And there were a decent amount of problems in my neighborhood. My neighbor's building had a piece of graffiti on it, which I think for the most part none of us really liked. It wasn't very good, and we wanted to get it removed. So I started calling City Hall, and in the process of calling City Hall, I kind of had this epiphany after waiting on hold for like the fourth time that this probably wasn't going to work. And I also realized that in that moment that a lot of people were probably having the same exact problem, and I really wanted to connect to them. And it was that strong desire to really connect to my neighbors who, for the most part, I didn't know, or if I knew, I wasn't having these constructive conversations with, that formed CClickFix, which is the platform I work on, which is a tool that allows citizens to publicly document anything in their community that's broken to governments and others. And I'll end by saying that one of the things that surprised us most about CClickFix was that we really thought that, that governments were going to be the only people that, that we would be holding accountable and that would be resolving the issues. Over 60% of the issues on the site are fixed, but what's interesting is that individuals have actually played a part in resolving those issues, as have traditional community groups and other organizations. But in the first 50 issues, there were a few that were actually resolved by citizens who said, I want to help, which I think is a great transition to Lenny and Local Mind.
Hi, I am Lenny Rachitsky. I am the CEO and co-founder of Local Mind. So what Local Mind is it's basically a social location-based Q&A service where basically we connect you to somebody that is at a place right now that you're thinking about going to, or someone that knows a lot about a place, and we give you an ability to ask any question you want about that place. And it's built on this assumption that people really like to help other people and that people will do that for free and that they'll do it quickly. And so it's built on this idea that people like to help other people. And the way we like to think about it is it connects the world. It connects you to any place in the world and somebody in that place in the world. And it basically creates these little tentacles and little wormholes into other people's eyes and ears and mouths around the world so you could find out what's happening in a place, what's good in a place, where people are headed, what the noise level is, if there's anything fun going on. And so we started the company about a year ago. It's very based on kind of social good and civil society and things like that. And so that's why I'm here. And I guess my neighborhood, if that's where we're supposed to be talking about, I live in this place called the DuBose Triangle in San Francisco. And the official name, apparently, is DuBose Triangle Art Ghetto. We've been doing a lot of work with neighborhood data, and so I learned that the other day, that it's called the DuBose Triangle Art Ghetto. I don't know why. That's it.
So I had a quick question for you. I am an avid Local Mind user. This is one of those tools that, yeah, I found out about it a year ago, and I was like, holy crap, this is awesome, and it probably won't work. And it turns out it really works. If you ask someone a question on Local Mind, they will answer it. I've had a nearly 100%
thank you.
Success ratio. It's amazing.
Thank you very much. I'll pay you for that later.
Hey, no problem. I've also answered a ton of questions myself, and I think that the app design is really brilliant. Clearly, you understand user behavior. I'm curious how you decide when you're asking to letting someone get too many questions, because it is invasive. I mean, it's a push notification, and you are doing something for a stranger.
Yeah. Should we get into an hour, or should we?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So so my team is here, actually, as well, and we all work on these things together. I wish I was as easy and just me. I wish it was that easy to do. Basically, what we do is we learn how much we can bother people. We adjust dynamically based on signals that we get from people. So, for example, we send a question to somebody. They don't answer. We learn that maybe we shouldn't be bothering this person either around this place or about this topic. And the more times they ignore a question, we learn, let's stop sending them questions about this. If they do answer, we'd learn, okay, they do like answering questions about these things, so let's keep sending them questions up to a limit. And we do that by type of question. We do that by location. We do that. We also have other signals. How often do they open up the app in general? How often do they ask their own questions to learn how much they want to participate in the community? And if we learn that they're not participating, let's leave them alone until they get in there again and then start bugging them again.
That's awesome. So next we have Catherine. Catherine, as I mentioned, is with Meetup, also something that has personally really affected my life. I've been to a number of meetups. Currently, I actually live in Vancouver half-time with my girlfriend, and it, if you've ever moved to a new place, it's really hard to find people, and I've met tons of awesome people through Meetup, so again, Shameless plug for you guys, but you know, it's something really powerful. So.
Very cool. So my name is Catherine. I'm the community development lead at Meetup. Meetup was actually a baby that came out of 9/11, essentially. Scott Heiferman, our CEO and founder, was living in New York and honestly had no real passion at that time for this kind of community building and that sort of thing. But after 9/11, he noticed that neighbors were saying hi to each other for the first time ever. People were more than ever willing to help each other and willing to connect. And so Meetup was born out of this, you know, desire to breed this kind of sustained connection with people in your neighborhood. To speak to my own understanding of, and actually, you know, so at this point, fast forward, we're just about to hit our 10-year anniversary, so we're sort of granddads in startup vocabulary, but we have over 10 million members now and are seeing that are millions of RSVPs every month. So we've learned a lot about communities ranging from first-time moms to hikers to people who work in the tech industry. So if you, you know, when you go back home, I highly encourage checking out your local meetup group about that. My own sense of community has really changed over the years. And when I was really young, I was very, you know, politically active and was really trying to take steps to change things at this massive national or global scale. And if any of you were like me in that sense, probably became disillusioned in that. And so now it's been really heartening working in this field and getting involved again at this local level, which I think is really appealing to a lot of people and obviously the crux of a lot of these platforms. Because seeing that change and getting that feedback immediately at the local community level is really powerful. So
I have a question for you because, I mean, Meetup is wildly successful, but you turn something that typically is not thought of as cool into something that is very cool, and that's the word community, right? I'm curious how Meetup has helped, you know, people our age get over that hump.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's funny. I still think that community is a very dorky kind of word. And we all, you know, especially up here, and I'm assuming you guys too, get really jazzed about that notion of community and these sort of lofty ideas of community building and, you know, people connecting face to face. And so, you know, what's funny is I actually think that most people who come to Meetup would still probably secretly say, like, oh, community's so dorky. And I don't think many people coming to Meetup are having this sort of existential angst, like, I really need community and I'm looking for a group. What they what they're coming to Meetup for is a need that they have or something they really want to get actually active in. And so I think that it's interesting. It becomes a question not of what is, you know, your social network, but it's what is your utility and, you know, what can you provide that's actually useful for people.
Well, that's a great transition to Daniel Hengfeld. How did it?
Yes, my name is Daniel Hengfeld. I'm the co-founder of a service called Neighbor Goods. And what we do is we connect people to share, lend, borrow possessions that they have that they may not get a lot of use out of. One really compelling stat that is sort of a catalyst for why we think this is so important is that the average power drill is used for 8 minutes before it ends up in a dumpster. And I think about the power drill in my garage that I've used about a dozen times. And instead of everyone going to Home Depot and buying a power drill when they need to drill something, there's all these people that live in your neighborhood that you may not know well that probably have things like drills, ladders, bicycles, sporting equipment, and whatnot. Anyway, our mission is to bring those people together and get more use out of these possessions that would otherwise sit idle.
Excellent. So I've heard of societies throughout history that survive on economies of giving, right?
Oh, of course.
It's like really peaceful societies that have existed in rare form throughout history, but certainly Neighbor Goods reminds me of this. And I'm curious if you have an opinion on, you know, how online participation through platforms like Neighbor Goods really can create true social reputation.
Sure. So to sort of take a slightly different angle to attack that question, you might say, right, we already have money and normal sort of financial transactions to build this sort of value and we have the economy keeping things together and going. But there's this whole class of interactions with people where money isn't really appropriate. Like all these I have things in my garage that I would never rent or sell, but I would very happily lend because it raises my status in the community, right? And this sort of trading this sort of social capital can tie a community together in a way that is just as effective as, you know, actual financial capital, and leads to these, I don't want to say, you know, utopian societies like you're talking about, but it's a different kind of marketplace, and it has secondary effects that lead to stronger communities.
Cool. We should. I hope this starts to take off in New Haven. That would be awesome.
Well, I hope so too.
Yeah. So, why do we have a government guy here? What's that about? We've C-Click Fix has been working really closely in the Gov2O movement with a lot of local governments, and for us, it's been amazing how many governments really are willing to play ball in this space and play with kids like us. Doug is the director of communications at the City of Austin, and has worked on a ton of awesome projects like Change by Us and Speak Up Austin here. And really has acted as a partner and not just a government official. And just thanks for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you described the reason that I'm here. Hopefully it wasn't just to fill the fifth table at the end of the day. The reason that I feel like I'm here is the role of local government in particular is changing. And I think that's evident if you look at what the TEDx Prize is this year. You know, the whole City 2.0 concept, you know, they're giving $10,000 micro grants to specific projects that will improve local communities. I think that that local communities and cities are starting to realize that there is some advantage to be gained by partnering with each one of the folks that are up at this table to solve some of the problems that either we haven't been able to solve ourselves, but also to address some of the issues that, quite frankly, we never should have been in the business in solving in the first place. And that's why this civil society term is so important to this dialogue, because civil society does not belong to government. However, government over the last 20 years seems to have filled that gap, and in some places I would argue has filled that gap inappropriately. So a lot of what we've been trying to do is identify the projects and the ideas that are out there and then see where that nexus is, where there's some mutual benefit. And each one of these platforms that's up here, and there's dozens of them around the country and around the world, you've got local governments that are looking at these solutions and then asking the questions, okay, well, how does this apply to us? And how can we help grow and foster this so that it makes the community a better place? And I know that may sound a little odd coming from a government bureaucrat, but the fact is the orientation is changing, and the orientation is changing in some respect out of necessity. We don't have the money. We don't have the agility. We don't have the bandwidth to do some of the things that we recognize are important, and we've got to start asking ourselves what's the best way to get those things done. And the answer is it's through these partners that are at the table and the other partners, a lot of whom are here at South by Southwest. We're coming at it from a little bit of a different angle. It's kind of a quasi-user angle. But one of the messages, I guess, that I wanted to get across is that we are a willing partner. And as you're thinking of what that next great new idea is, don't think that government is the problem. Government may actually be a willing partner to help you in finding that solution.
And I actually have a follow-on comment from that. I think it's important to think about not only privatizing things that government does now that government might not be very good at doing, you know, where you're partnering directly taking action, for example, mm-hmm. and that makes your job easier, more efficient, or, you know, takes that job right. and puts it on someone else's plate. But there's also the fact that any service like Neighborgoods, like Meetup, like Local Mind, that just gets people in neighborhoods to talk to each other and to know each other better, helps local government work more efficiently across the board of all of their tasks, because a community that interacts, if I know my neighbor's name, you know, if I can chat with people on the sidewalk as I see them walking their dogs, the community will be safer, will require less, you know, there'll be less things to fix.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, actually, we see a lot of really exceptional stuff come out of people taking action via meetup groups, but far and away the majority of that, whether it's, you know, affecting legislation to forming babysitting co-ops, none of that, almost none of that comes out of explicitly volunteer or activist meetup groups. And so what's really cool is to see that it's actually kind of a natural extension out of what you were saying, of simply people coming together is better on many levels. So, you know, trying to think, you know, I'm glad to hear that the government's not thinking, like, how can we get people to come volunteer for us? You know, the better question is probably how can we empower people to self-organize? Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that, we were just talking about this earlier, I don't know how many folks here are familiar with the Change By Us, changeby.us. That was a Code for America project, partner with CEOs for Cities. And I think it's one of those examples of bridging the gap. You know, you've got ideation platforms, and you've got platforms that are starting to get folks talking, and you've got platforms that are starting to get folks coalescing. The question is, what's the next step? You've got to help bridge the folks that are talking into coalescing, and that's not always the government's job.
And I think what Ben was saying when he was introducing himself at the beginning of the panel about how they were surprised to find that individuals are fixing things, and they're coming together and doing it and taking that out of government's hands.
Yeah, absolutely. And locally for us, I'm pointing over to one of our audience members here, but you know, locally for us, we, as an example, you know, I'm not making this up. We are actually willing partners. I had a member of the community come to me with an idea for an ideation platform. We were looking for an ideation platform and weren't particularly satisfied with what was out there. IdeaScale and some of those were great one-offs, but it didn't create a meaningful dialogue between us and the community. So we embarked on a little project together. He had a couple of private sector partners, but he didn't have a public sector partner. So we spent a year actually as a test market for that product. We launched it for the city of Austin. We were on the phone with him probably more than they wanted us to be on the phone with him, asking for different features, different changes, different design, helping refine that product over the course of a year in order to get it essentially market ready. And once it was market ready, they were able to spin that off and take it national. What we got was something that was designed to spec. It was designed to do all the things that we wanted. What they got was a product that had been tested. And there are opportunities like that, and I would encourage you to consider that as you're thinking through your idea.
Absolutely. That's something that social web can learn from local governments is even if you're not building something to spec for the city of Austin, there's all these, having worked with local government, there's all these people in local government that want to do the hard parts of getting your company off the ground for you because they see the benefits down the road, right? The libraries want to be your marketing department. You know, So there's all this, I don't want to come across like an opportunist and say there's all this free labor out there, but like governments really, really want to help you because you're going to help them in the long run. And this is a resource that a lot of people in our part of the internet don't realize and don't take advantage of because, like you were alluding to earlier, government bureaucrats aren't the first person you think of when you think of launching your consumer product. And even if it's not something directly related to a function of government, local governments are still excited about it because they just want their communities to be more integrated, more involved.
So let's, I would love to jump into some anecdotal evidence of how this has affected citizens. I could start with a fun story on C-Click Fix. A couple weeks ago, one that I haven't seen before, in downtown New Haven, there is a hot dog vendor in between City Hall and the Bank of America building. And he serves hot dogs to bureaucrats and corporate suits all day long.
Civil servants is actually the term we prefer.
Right, civil servants. Excuse me. And Jimmy, the hot dog vendor, serves hot dogs to them with techno music blasting in the background, really blasting. He was reported on C-Click Fix as a noise violation. I was worried. And so I went on, and you know, within a couple hours of the report, there were already a number of people who had come out and said, "We love Jimmy. Jimmy is awesome. He's an ex-con. He's part of a prison, a reentry program, and he's we love this guy. He's great. Please do not fix Jimmy the hot dog vendor." So I felt really good about that. I added my voice to that as well. And I noticed afterwards, I only looked at the comments first, but I noticed afterwards that the person who had reported the issue had said, "We feel that Jimmy the hot dog vendor is a problem," right? And there was like this implied "we." However, no one else on the site, and CClickFix is pretty omnipotent in New Haven. It's, the data is displayed on the homepages of multiple local newspapers. A lot of people see this thing. In fact, Jimmy the hot dog vendor saw this and said that he would turn down the music, which no one was really asking for except for this particular "we." And I think that's really interesting because, in a way, you know, there's this idea of co-presence, that we're so much more aware of the people around us now, and we may behave differently because of that. If this person had just contacted City Hall and made a stink about it without having the conversation publicly, Jimmy the hot dog vendor might have been removed from the front steps where he's been for a very long time. But instead, a lot of people came out and supported him. The real "we" came out. And I think that, you know, that really speaks to the power of what's going on here. So I'd love to hear.
Yeah, and that's got to be so fulfilling as an entrepreneur to see stuff like that and meet people in real life that are affected by your services. That's some of my favorite things about starting LocalMind. So some of the examples that I've followed up on, it's always a little bit creepy to follow up on some of the questions and answers in LocalMind because, you know, they're interacting and then I email them and they're like, "How did you know? That's weird." But there's kind of a spectrum of, you know, trivial examples of how people's lives have changed, and then there's like interesting, really serious stuff. So kind of on the fun angle, there was an example of someone sending a question to a concert venue, and someone got the question. Then they're like, "Hey, I have an extra ticket. You want to come by and I'll give it to you?" And they ended up meeting, and he got the ticket, and he went to the concert. Another one is someone was going to the San Diego Zoo, and they went there last week, and the baby hippo wasn't out yet. And so it was kind of a ruined experience. So this time they used LocalMind, they opened it up, they sent a question to someone at the zoo. They asked if the baby hippo was there. It was there. And then they went and told us they had a great time. On the other side of the spectrum, there's things like someone emailed us that they were planning a date with their fiancé on their anniversary, and they were at dinner, and they were trying to figure out where to go for dessert, and they sent a question and got this great place that they really liked. Some really interesting stuff. There's a road in Egypt called the El Rehab Road that apparently is really dangerous, and people, some girl sent a question to an expert of that road and asked, "Can I drive across this road? Is it safe? What should I know?" And she got five answers from people that know a lot about that road, and they gave her advice. They started chatting, and she never got back to me, so I don't know what happened. But that was really interesting. Another really interesting one is Japan after the tsunami in Japan. People started sending questions to people in Japan, trying to figure out what's happening, what can we do to help, how far has the water gotten. And it's something that we realized is, how else can you contact people in a specific place right now? You know, so if you want to just talk to someone in Japan to see what's happening in Japan, how else can you do that? There's another way to do that. And so we realized that this is a really interesting platform for that kind of thing. Another interesting thing, just real quick, is we've been seeing a lot of people asking questions about, where can I find a job in this area? So they pick, you know, like Sacramento, and they're like, "Hey, I'm looking for a job. Does anyone know where I can get some work?" And we kind of recognize that it's just kind of a reflection of the state of the world, of society right now. Just, this is what people are interested in. That's the kind of questions they're going to ask. And this is a new vector for them to find ways to help themselves. So I love seeing that kind of stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, so I'm personally most interested in and enthused by these much more kind of intimate things that come out of meetup groups and people connecting there. So, you know, everything from a member of the mom's group is sick, and so they, you know, volunteer to bring over food for the family and things like that. I think it's actually quite radical and, you know, has a lot of far-reaching implications. But to talk to that spectrum question, one of my favorite recent examples of something that came out of meetups was during the, in January, during sort of the height of the SOPA PIPA awareness and activity. The New York Tech Meetup, which is you know, this great hub for the tech community, scheduled an emergency meetup in front of Schumer's office to protest in real life on the ground. And so I wrote to a lot of the tech organizers of different meetup groups that were all in the area, and thousands of people came out that day. And, you know, I am fully aware of all the wonderful, amazing, inspiring activity that was going on online as well as offline. But, you know, we really think that was an important step to have taken. And that's a great example of, again, these weren't activist groups. And a lot of the people in the tech meetups that showed up that day originally joined a tech meetup simply because they were a developer and wanted to learn from other developers. So almost kind of like a, I mean, I won't call it selfish, but, you know, a self-interest instead of a shared interest necessarily. But really great things can come out of that. So
I think that rather than specific examples, I want to talk about sort of a class of users on NeighborGoods that surprised me and explain why I think that this is important. So our user base, there's a small core of people that really like to lend their stuff. And then there's a lot of people that like to borrow, as you might expect. Like any content sharing platform has a lot of people that share and a lot of people that consume. But one thing that I think is really fascinating is every community has, like, the friendly guy with a lot of tools, or, like, in my neighborhood, you know, I'm the friendly guy with a lot of bicycles. And, you know, I'm happy to lend things out. And these people really want other people to use their tools. And then they find a tool like NeighborGoods that lets them sort of amplify their weak ties to the rest of the neighborhood. And suddenly they become almost like community institutions, like the neighborhood tool shed and the neighborhood bike shed. Whereas before, these guys would have all this stuff, and you'd need like a group like the Bicycle Kitchen in Los Angeles to spring up and be a nonprofit and get volunteers. And these guys being able to multiply their lending force with a tool like this gets you these free nonprofit equivalents of like a community tool shed or the community bike shed or whatever. And it's really cool because that sort of thing happening externally, like organizations starting up, governments, you know, building tool sheds or whatever, that only happens in certain kinds of communities. Like a place like Austin, yeah, you know, a place like Portland, yeah, but there are all sorts of local governments that aren't as forward-thinking and don't have as much resources. And the fact that these institutions can spring up without these people thinking of themselves as activists, like you were saying, like they just want to lend stuff out, and they're having the same function as these, you know, groups in other cities would have. And I think that's really important because essentially where the effectiveness from these tools, like improving communities, comes from, in my opinion, is strengthening weak ties, right? I don't need to be connected to Chris and Mark here in the front row because I can just text them. But like Mark's brother or Chris's college friend or whatever that I don't really know well, but I would probably help out if they showed up on my front porch. Like, those are the people that I need to form connections with, and these tools doing that is what's giving us these secondary effects that are, you know, making civil society more awesome.
It's interesting to think about the individual as a natural resource in your community. Right? That's cool.
Well, yeah, and for our part, you know, I do want to kind of zero in on one of the things that you talked about, which is the concept of co-presence, which we're all co-present in this room right now. And because of that, because I can see you, you're going to behave a little differently than you would if you were by yourself or if you were with a specific group of friends. Or your behavior changes according to who else can see the way that you behave. And this is one of the areas where governments tend to be their own worst enemy. When we started talking about Speak Up Austin, the first question was, well, what happens when people start getting nasty and calling us names and using profanity and posting links to porn and all of these horrible things that are going to happen in this space? And what I find myself doing more often than not when we're posing these ideas is saying, look, just give it a try. And it's because of that co-presence concept, we have yet to have a major issue in any of the platforms that we've launched. And I think everybody here can kind of say that same thing. And when we go back to the topic of the discussion today, what can civil society learn from the social web? It's that society is still civil. In that if you create a space for people to gather, whether it's a virtual space or an actual space, in general, folks will police themselves and they will work towards a positive end. And I think that that's a really, really powerful message. And I'm sure that you all could probably talk a little bit more about that in your specific platforms than I could.
Okay. A funny story, when we opened up a new feature in LocalMind that allowed you to answer questions with photos, we had a bet internally of how long it would take to have the first male member show up.
Literally,
yeah, exactly.
And interestingly enough, it was a senator.
And I don't think we've seen one yet. It's been like a year, I think, since we launched it. We had like 3 weeks, 2 days, 4 months in the pool, and we still haven't seen that. And so, we're still young. It's still early for us, but it's incredible that people do treat the system well and they police it themselves.
I think there's an additional layer that everyone up here, we have the advantage of. So doing work at the local level is extremely challenging and has its own special problems than something that's strictly online. But it has its advantages, too. And I think when you're talking about local, there's an extra sense of commitment and responsibility and the fact that there are repercussions there, which tends to help out. But
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, if you're on some website posting anonymously on the national scene, like commenting on a New York Times article or whatever, you might say terrible things. But if you're using a service that is essentially connecting you with your neighbors, I mean, this guy lives next door to you. You're not going to say terrible things. Like, he could come knock on your door and ask you why you said the terrible things. And people behave a lot better, I think, in that sort of tool than in just general purpose internet comments.
And I think what helps that as well is I think we're all being forced into being public. Our reputation is being put online. We're creating real identities online, and everything we do is tied to that same identity. And so if you do something wrong, everyone will know that. And so we're kind of being forced to be good because everyone can see what we're doing.
I think it's not just accountability, though, which we're all touching on here, but I think it's also a kind of hopefulness and awesomeness that comes out of this sort of community building. So you see the positive impact that you can have, and you want more of that. It's kind of addictive. I know I said earlier that, it's pretty rare that someone's like, I'm seeking out community. Instead, you're seeking out a need that you have. But once you kind of get going in that, what we've seen and what I'm sure you guys are seeing, it's kind of a quick upward slope.
Yeah, I think, and I want to make one comment along those lines. Earlier, I suggested that our user base, NeighborGoods, has a small group of people that are motivated to lend and many people that are motivated to borrow. And what we find is that, like, our initial assumptions were we'll build a service that makes it easy for people to save money and borrow stuff, assuming that they would be the ones that were most motivated. Like, that was the core of what a NeighborGoods user would want. But honestly, what the really active and excited NeighborGoods users don't care about borrowing a drill, saving time, and saving money. What they really want to do is help other people out. And it's actually a lot easier. It's harder for people to be willing to borrow than to be willing to lend. And so there is that urge, I don't know if it's just to increase the reputation in the community or what, but people really, really, really want to help. And as long as our tools make it easy for those people to help, I think we'll have success improving civil society.
And so, I think having the tools that empower folks to step out of who they may otherwise be is very, very important. One of the biggest challenges that we have in government is you've got kind of this small group of folks who will shout down anybody in a public meeting that doesn't agree with them. Well, what that does is then limit the amount of input that you get because you've got 95% of your population is never going to show up for a meeting. Well, what each one of these groups does is create a space where folks start to develop a voice, and it's a safe space. And there's nothing more valuable for us in local government than a safe space where somebody feels like they can speak up and voice their opinion without that fear of what's going to happen because they're in that angry mob of people speaking on a specific issue for government. It's really, really important and compelling to me that we're starting to create these safe spaces where folks can start to generate their own identity and express themselves.
Mm. Yeah, I think... lowering the barrier to participation is really an important piece here. It's not just that it's new tools. I joke around that reporting a pothole can be a gateway drug to civic engagement, because as mundane as that is, there are a lot of potholes, and they frustrate people, and asking someone to speak up about a pothole can really be a first step towards creating that, getting that feedback loop from community members, from your government. I feel like everyone here has been involved in things that are creating really, really important social value. So besides just everyone in the room tweeting about it, I'm interested in how you guys have scaled, plan to scale internationally, locally, because it is it's a hard challenge. I know at CClickFix we've done that by partnering with governments, but also a bigger piece initially was partnering with local media companies who are already in those communities. It isn't easy to scale locally, nationally, so I'm interested to hear.
I'm interested to hear Catherine's answer, because they've obviously accomplished it, and we're still dealing with that. We're still trying to solve that. Someone put it well that with local, it's not a marketplace problem, which is enough of a hard problem to solve. It's infinite numbers of marketplace problems, because you have to have both sides in every location. And so we don't have the answer yet. One of the things we do is we sit on top of other people's platforms, and so that we don't have to build our own community completely from scratch. We sit on top of Foursquare, for example, and so when people are checking in, we learn where they are and where they've been and what they know about. And so that's helped us. But I don't know. I don't have a great answer.
I think the future of API and collaborative platforms is one of the most exciting things ahead of us, and we've already seen some great experiments. To speak to Meetup's history, so we have grown completely by word of mouth, so never doing advertising or traditional marketing and that kind of thing. And so what you will see over the course of Meetup's history are these kind of spikes where we saw all these great use cases and people actually using the platform, but then you had things like the Howard Dean campaign, which was one of the first things that shot Meetup forward, and then some other things that we don't like to mention as much, like being the backbone of the Tea Party. So you had Glenn Beck, who didn't start tons of Meetup groups. All he did was say, hey, there's this site Meetup, you can use it to start your own group, and now we have 912 groups and Tea Party groups and Glenn Beck groups, and those are all self-organized, but it was sort of propelled that way. So these spikes kind of help to kind of drive everything forward, although lately I think what we've seen the most interesting gains on is just simply by incorporating more of that social element into the user experience.
So as far as scaling these services with NeighborGoods, I can't, like Lenny, we're still working on it, but I can sort of speak frankly about our challenges and based on what I've been talking about in the panel so far, like where we're going to go with it. So the biggest challenge with a service like NeighborGoods is ending up in a city somewhere or a small town where there aren't enough people to have enough inventory to be able to borrow things and lend things. And we launched nationally, and then we ended up with a few sort of nexuses of sharing. And then a lot of people kind of in small communities sort of isolated 80 miles from there, like someone, 80 miles up Highway 35 and all the stuff they want to borrow is in Austin. So we looked at that, and we came to a lot of these conclusions about weak ties and strengthening them. And obviously I've brought it up a bunch of times. I think it's really important. So what we're trying to do now in terms of growing and expanding is identifying communities that have a lot of weak ties and seeing how well we can grow in those and then reproducing that in similar communities. So a specific example is church groups. There are many large churches in the country, and they're all full of people that are, hopefully friendly with each other, but you can't know all. Like, I don't know how big a big church is, but I know there are many with thousands of members, right? You can't know all those people face to face. But if we can partner with groups like that, or universities is another great example, existing neighborhood groups, and find the weak ties, and then say, okay, now we know how to grow in a university, or we know how to grow in a church, and then it's just a matter of finding every group that has similar demographics to the ones that we like closely analyze, and spreading everywhere forever until we take over the world.
So we have about 15 minutes left. Do you guys want to ask questions?
I'd love to hear some of the work you guys are doing, actually. Brave souls.
I wanted to know if, I'm assuming everyone except Doug, are you all not nonprofit?
I think we're all businesses, actually.
Yeah,
we're all for profit. How are you funded?
We just care about the money. I don't know. Wait, isn't that what this panel's been about?
Yes, I was a throw-in at the end of the planning process.
How are you funded?
We raised a seed round of funding from investors.
And how do they receive a yield?
How
do they get a return on their investment?
IPO.
Where do you get your revenues from?
So we're a social mobile app that is focused on growth at this point. Revenue comes down the road. We have to grow and capture market share first. So we have ideas and we have plans around revenue, but it's not something we're focusing on now.
Okay. And Meetup?
Meetup was free for a long time, and then we decided to switch over to subscription-based model. So each of those local groups is run by an organizer or many organizers. And so the head organizer of the tech meetup group pays a subscription fee to Meetup. It's incredibly nominal, but at scale, it really helps. But what was really scary is when we went from free to that subscription, you can imagine how the numbers just... it's almost kind of like rebuilding from scratch. But we think that asking community members to pay leads to a better experience at least in the Meetup world, that you're more invested and you're more willing to put effort into creating community.
So as far as Neighborgoods goes, we raised some money from investors to work on our product. But we aren't simply trying to capture market share and hope revenue comes later. We have because we're entirely... constructed around physical goods and exchanging them, there's a lot of kind of obvious ways to tie in, like work with retailers to say, if your community doesn't have a drill, then you can buy a drill and get sort of referrals through that. We have a paid groups system, kind of similar to Meetup subscription. And actually, coming up this year, we've got a sort of a new product. I'm not sure how much I can really talk about it, but... has more of a concrete kind of a social currency related model, but yeah, we are actively trying to make money.
Okay,
and we're funded in large part by sales taxes. So make sure you go to lots of restaurants and buy lots of beverages while you're here.
Good transition, Doug. We are also funded by taxes. Governments pay us, as well as our media partners. And it's been going very well, surprisingly.
Hi, my name is Athika Kaki. I thank you all. This has been a really fascinating conversation. I wanted to mention two things. One, to sort of share a project that utilizes the social web. I work at the ACLU, the national office in New York, and we have a project right now called Reckoning with Torture. If you want to know more, go to reckoningwithtorture.org. And we are working with filmmaker Doug Liman, who directed Born Identity, and asking people to help us make a movie to stand against torture. And so it's sort of adapting a performance event that we did. We've broken it up into script readings, and we're using Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube mostly to ask people to submit readings of themselves. And the final film will be, Robert Redford and some random guy in Illinois side by side. So, hopefully that's another inspiring, another way that nonprofits are using the social web and existing platforms. And then I'm also here representing our Dot Rights campaign, which is all about digital privacy. And I'm wondering if you guys can speak to sort of how to balance, keeping what people want to keep private and while still allowing some of these connections to happen, and sort of how you balance, privacy versus connecting.
I would speak to that. That's a really interesting question and something we've always dealt with since the beginning. Our kind of rule of thumb is that if we believe that as a whole, the piece of the conversation is valuable to everyone, it's socially valuable, then it should be public. We get into this a lot more with our government clients because they initially they wanted all of it to be private. Right, open data was not a cool thing 4 years ago. Thank God that has changed. You know, they want to know your phone number, and so we try to help determine whether giving a phone number to the government is really that important for fixing a pothole. Right, we don't say no, but we say obviously that's a piece of private information. If the conversation is important for the good or greater whole, then that should be an open conversation, in our opinion.
My general rule on privacy is I feel like people are willing to risk losing their privacy if they feel like they have control and if they feel like there's value that they're going to get out of giving up that kind of privacy. So, for example, I'll tell Facebook theoretically anything as long as I feel like I have control over what they're going to expose and whether I'm going to get something out of that. They screwed up on the control. They just started changing things. And so if they hadn't messed that up, if people don't mess that up, I think people are okay giving up things like there are some parts of their privacy.
Yeah, I think the return on your investment, so to speak, is really key. The control is the other main issue. So for meetup groups you can be part of, you know, you can hide the groups you belong to, and it's case by case whether a meetup group is totally public or private. We leave that up to the local people to decide. Your project sounds awesome, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
NeighborGoods is really dicey with privacy. That came out wrong.
I'm going to tweet that right now.
Nobody tweet that. So it is very challenging to handle privacy with a service like NeighborGoods because we are talking about your physical possessions. And not only that, you're advertising like a large amount of your physical possessions. Like you could look and see everything that's in my garage and go and, right? That's what people think. That's what they're afraid of. Hasn't happened. Don't think it's going to happen. But we give people very fine-grained privacy controls because that's going to be something that's very, you know, very personal and specific to each person. I have most of my stuff public, but we let people, you know, hide what they want to hide. Right. And I think that we always will let people be very private on NeighborGoods simply because we understand how people feel about their possessions and the risk of sharing them. So, like, our mission is to really make them feel comfortable doing that. And if that means less of the stuff is advertised, I think that's a reasonable trade-off.
Ours is dictated by state law, so it's pretty black and white for us.
Howdy. Someone in the vein of the trade-off of what you get for participating in these kinds of things. Daniel, something that you said that was very interesting to me, possibly for obvious reasons, is it's harder for people to be willing to borrow than to lend.
Absolutely.
Which is a very interesting thing. In terms of kind of people accepting things for free are very reluctant to do that. And a lot of these kind of services and things that you guys are talking about, especially Local Mind, I don't know, how do you break down that wall? I'd like to hear from each of you.
Well, with NeighborGoods, we've done a lot of work on I mentioned earlier we've got some new things coming out. And a lot of it has to do with this exact problem that you're describing. And what we think is going to be really effective is getting that borrower to get over the hesitation to borrow by making them feel like they can reward the lender in some way. And I referred earlier to some work we're doing around social currency, and the idea is as long as the borrower feels like in some way the borrower feels in some way the lender is going to get a tangible benefit to their life, they almost feel like they're doing the person a favor, right? It's like, I'll borrow this from you because I know that it'll enable you to, you know, participate in this system more effectively through this system we're sort of alpha-ing right now. And so it's really about that, like, psychology of convincing the borrower that they're actually helping the lender out and not imposing them, and, like, any tricks you can pull to make them feel like they're the one doing the favor will, it really helps growth.
So the way you put it is exactly the problem we have at LocalMind is it's a lot harder to get people to ask questions than it is to answer questions. Initially, I thought it was, why are people going to answer questions? Why would they spend their time answering these questions? But it turns out people love to do that. The biggest complaint we hear is, I don't get enough questions. I want to get more questions. And so that's the number one problem that we solve, that we're trying to solve, because if people aren't asking questions, they're never going to open up the app, and nobody's going to be asking questions, and there's nothing going on. And so that is our number one goal, is connecting a problem that you have in your head with LocalMind, so that every time you think of that, you open it up and you ask that question. But it's interesting, right? Like, you're getting this free service. Why don't you go in there and why don't you use it? But it's, yeah, you got to remind the person that this exists is our biggest problem.
Thanks. Last question. We got a couple minutes left. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank from Open Plans. You talked about scaling. I'm interested in your thoughts on scaling these tools and methods to help marginalized, underrepresented communities. Mm. So, you know, what are you learning from what you're doing in trying to build your businesses that could be useful to organizers, planners, people who are trying to make cities better?
So, Clay Johnson from the Sunlight Foundation, whenever I speak, I must be getting old or something because he's not sitting right on the front here, always asks, well, what about disenfranchised communities, right? And it's a serious issue. In New Haven with See Click Fix, though, we've really seen it spread to other communities. And our answer to it is, well, let's give the data to everyone. I mean, the data's open, but let's actually really put it in people's faces. So if you wanted to look at the New Hallville neighborhood in New Haven, a lower-income neighborhood with a lot of crime, versus East Rock, a wealthy neighborhood with a lot of break-ins, but not, you know, nothing dangerous for the most part, you would see less participation in those communities. And one thing we did recently is we launched with Oakland, California, with the city, and we had huge spikes of participation in the Northern Oakland. I've never been to Oakland. I assume that that is a more connected, wealthier community, but maybe something else is going on there. And you can see that there is not much activity yet in Southern Oakland. So we sent out an email to all the users in Northern Oakland and said, hey, thank you so much for connecting early. But here's the thing. You have been provided this really valuable service connecting to your government. Other people don't know about it yet. We need your help. And we have had people who have offered to put up flyers in neighborhoods for their other neighbors. Actually, one of them said that our design kind of sucked for our flyer, and his architect, he went and redesigned the entire thing over the course of a weekend with his team, and they're out there putting it out. But for me, I really believe that letting folks know that that is a problem and making them aware of it with the data is a way to engage other people, because everyone knows someone on the other side of town, right?
I have something I'd really like to say about that as well. So it's obviously a very big challenge for a for-profit company addressing communities that are less affluent, right? How do you solve that? Like, what are your tools? You can't use the typical entrepreneur toolbox. And what we find is that you really have to go to partners that don't have a profit motive. In other words, government. So we don't know how to get into certain neighborhoods in San Jose, the right way to market, because that was one of our pilot communities. But the government of San Jose has very close ties with community leaders, libraries, religious groups, all these sort of on-the-ground people in every neighborhood, because they care as much about every neighborhood, right? And so that's really good, and we can use their sort of enthusiasm and on-the-ground knowledge to our advantage. So finding those partners is really essential for helping disenfranchised communities, because I think it's possible without these partners, but it's hugely challenging for like the typical entrepreneur. Mm-hmm.
For us, South by Southwest is the perfect place to test scale. This is the perfect place where every place in the world, in freaking downtown Austin, has a LocalMind user, and the map is covered with people, and there's no better way to figure out how to fix that problem than being here and seeing it in action. And so that's the one way to solve that problem, is find that little test bed that concentrates all that activity.
Just one word on disenfranchised communities, because that's one of the things that we've really spent a lot of time thinking through, is as we implement these tech tools, how do we create, for instance, the ideal integrated community meeting where everybody has an equivalent opportunity to participate. And we've started experimenting with various tools where we'll have an in-person meeting, we'll broadcast it live, we'll also broadcast it over the web. We brought in Cover It Live so folks could watch it on the web and submit their questions. We've got text to web, we've got text to phone, we've got phone. We've set up one meeting where we had virtually every way that you could communicate covered. And for us, while participation was good, for us the real indication that we were successful is when we got a texted in question from a teenager who said, "I'm sending this on behalf of my grandmother, who's mobility challenged, who wouldn't be able to come to this meeting, but here's her question." For me, that's a win. And it wouldn't have been possible without the work that these folks are doing, the work that a lot of the folks in this room are doing. But we're not done. I mean, we're just on the cusp of all of this. And the key is thinking through what the next step is and who the right partners are. I don't think that we've landed on what that answer is yet. And it's the reason that we're still having this conversation, I think.
Cool. Well, thank you all for coming. I believe time is up. The shuttle back to downtown Austin leaves every 5 minutes from the front of the Omni. It's been great. And thanks to all you guys. Before you shuttle off, though,
I really did mean that. I would love it if anyone has a few minutes to spare and wants to come up and just share what you're working on. It would be great to chat with some of you guys. So
yeah, we'll hang out.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.